It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The economy may be starting to grow, but people are still losing jobs. A few firms, as a matter of policy, refused to lay off even a single employee. New Hampshire Public Radio's John Greenberg looks at a couple of them.
The Hypertherm factory sits hidden in the woods, not far from Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Inside, in a testing room, a jet of superheated ionized gas slices smoothly through an inch of plate steel. Hypertherm is one of the world's top manufacturers of plasma cutting tools. Director of Operations Jim Miller says when the world is making big, heavy things, Hypertherm does quite well.
Maybe a shipbuilder, automotive manufacturing, anywhere where you see flat steel, you would see an application for our products.
Unfortunately, late last year, the making of ships and cars pretty much ground to a halt. Sales of cutting systems at Hypertherm dropped 50%. How many workers did the company lay off? None. It put them to work doing other things. Normally, Lindsay Grace works on the production floor. Now she rakes leaves and maintains the grounds.
In the beginning, I was really scared to lose my job, and now I've had the opportunity to just come and do something different to help the company out.
Hypertherm saves money by doing everything in-house that it possibly can. Plus, it puts workers into training or assigns them to teams to rejigger the production line. The goal is to emerge from recession in a better position to compete. Company founder and CEO Dick Couch sees no tension between doing well by the employees and doing well by the company.
Once you have a highly trained technical workforce, the last thing you want to do is lay them off. And this isn't altruism. It's good business.
Couch says if he were making T-shirts, this strategy would fail. High-end products, experienced workers, and guaranteed jobs are a winning combination. Very few firms fit this mold, but Hypertherm is not alone. The granddaddy of the no-layoff companies is Lincoln Electric in Cleveland, Ohio. The maker of welding systems has been around for well over 100 years. It's a global company with over $1 billion in sales. Lincoln Electric CEO John Stropke says people considering this model need to go into it with their eyes wide open.
This doesn't come without additional pressure and challenges for management. And I would say equally, it doesn't come without additional pressures and challenges for the workforce.
Managers give up the flexibility to hire and fire as they please. Workers give up a guaranteed paycheck. Profit sharing is a big part of the model. When business is good, pay goes up. When it goes down, so does your pay. At Lincoln Electric, the work week shrank to 32 hours. Labor journalist Frank Collar just finished a book about no-layoff companies. Collar says this model rubs organized labor the wrong way. They prefer a guaranteed income to a guaranteed job.
Union leaders were very, very suspicious of this. They saw this as a tool for exploitation. And there's no question that in some work environments it probably was.
But Collar says today, workers at these companies do very well. The typical Lincoln Electric assembler can make over $70,000. Jordan Siegel at the Harvard Business School says the American economy would benefit if more firms adopted this model of shared gain and shared sacrifice. He's been doing work in South Korea, where the recession had relatively little impact on unemployment.
There's been just a lot of this kind of shared sacrifice, people sharing some reductions in compensation in order to avoid layoffs.
If these firms, both overseas and at home, are so successful, why don't more companies jump on board? Siegel says mainly because this idea is too different. He hopes the recession prompts more executives to take off the blinders when it comes to the no-layoff option. For NPR News, I'm John Greenberg in Concord, New Hampshire.
The Obama administration soon will be awarding billions of dollars in education grants to help local school districts raise the bar on student achievement. In order to qualify for the money, schools may have to grade not only their students, but their teachers as well. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Speaking at a middle school in Madison, Wisconsin yesterday, President Obama said one of the most important factors in student success is the teacher in front of their classroom. That's why a system for identifying good teachers is one of the main requirements. For schools that want some of the more than $4 billion in challenge grants, the Education Department is preparing to award.
We've got to do a better job recruiting and preparing new teachers. We've got to do a better job of rewarding outstanding teachers. And I've got to be honest, we've got to do a better job of moving bad teachers out of the classroom once they've been given an opportunity to do it right.
As part of its grant-making process, the federal government is encouraging schools to collect a lot more information about how students perform during the year and to use that information as part of teachers' evaluation. U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan says student performance shouldn't be the only yardstick for judging teachers, but it should be part of the mix.
There are teachers every single year where the average child in their class is gaining 2 years of growth. Those teachers are the unsung heroes in our society. Shouldn't we know that? And the flip side of it, if you have teachers or schools where students are falling further and further behind each year, I think we need to know that as well.
Teachers' unions have traditionally been wary of any system that rewards or punishes teachers on the basis of students' test scores. Some states, including Wisconsin, have gone so far as to ban the practice. But in order to qualify for the federal grants, Wisconsin is preparing to change its law, with the blessing of State Teachers Union President Mary Bell.
We as professional educators give tests, write tests, and use tests all the time. It is a question of knowing what the test says and what it doesn't say, and what it measures and what it doesn't.
Mr. Obama cautioned that important as teachers are, students and parents also play a vital role. He mentioned how his own daughter had to knuckle down after a disappointing score of 73 on a recent sixth grade science test. With her parents' encouragement, Malia Obama redoubled her efforts. On her next test, she scored a 95. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
40-year-old, 6-foot-5-inch, Utah-born and raised Jared Hess had a cult smash hit with the 2004 comedy Napoleon Dynamite, in which a tall, gawky Utah nerd finds love and does a funky dance. Hess's new comedy, which he co-wrote with his wife Jerusha, is called Gentlemen Broncos. The movie opened in limited release last Friday to wildly mixed reviews, and our film critic David Edelstein wants to make the case for it.
I don't think there's ever been a comedy as freakishly, surreally psychosexual as Jared Hess's Gentlemen Broncos. It's the story of a teenager who writes unpublished, Dune-like sci-fi novels called Yeast Wars, in which the hero has his gonads stolen and faces off in a rocky desert against laser-blasting memories. The kid, Benjamin, played by Michael Angarano, is clearly sublimating like mad to relieve his sexual discomfort. But often Hess cuts to his fantasies, scenes from his novels enacted on screen. And they're so visionary and intense that they hurtle past Freud. They have a Jung-like, mythical dimension. His protagonist, Bronco, played by Sam Rockwell, is part cowboy, part Flash Gordon. His battles are gloriously tacky and psychedelic. He rides robotic deer and dodges cyclops and pursues a jelly jar with his pilfered private parts. These fantasies lift the movie into a realm both lofty and madcap. The down-to-earth realm is loco in a different way. Hess co-wrote and directed Napoleon Dynamite and the Mexican wrestler comedy with Jack Black, Nacho Libre, and at times he uses deadpan like a cudgel. Geeky characters stare off screen with their mouths hanging open. They're uncomfortable in their own flesh. Benjamin is homeschooled and awkward around people. He moves through the world on the verge of tears, looking as if he wants to will his own body out of existence. I've never seen a teen hero so stricken. His mom is the wonderful actress Jennifer Coolidge, who's comically full-figured, yet playing a character trying to become a designer with a line of ultra-modest nightgowns, while Benjamin's own work explodes with sex and violence. When Benjamin leaves his dome house to travel to a convention of young, would-be fantasy writers, he gets to meet his author hero, Dr. Ronald Chevalier, played by Jemaine Clement of Flight of the Conchords. Even if you love Jemaine on TV, you'll be unprepared for his brilliance here. He wears a dark, heavy beard and speaks in the toasty tones of James Mason's Captain Nemo. He gives a lecture in how to name one's characters, then calls on Benjamin, who's bewildered by his role model's fatuous pomposity.
Need thou not be afraid, for we can turn a humdrum, forgettable name like Nebuchadnezzar into something magical like this. Nebuchadnezzar. And it's that easy. We can add Onius, Inus, or Anus to just about anything, and it becomes magical. You, give me the name of one of your central protags.
Bronco.
What is he? A centaur?
No.
Does he shapeshift into equine form ever?
No, he's just a man.
Well, then, I would lose the C immediately, and I'd replace it with an L, Bronlonius.
Gentleman Broncos finally turns on the theft of Benjamin's work. Chevalier steals his manuscript, inserting, of course, his own ridiculous character names, and turning Bronco into a transvestite. We see scenes from his Yeast Wars acted on screen, and they're even more bizarre than Benjamin's. Then a girl named Tabitha, played by a hilariously deadpan Hallie Pfeiffer, pays Benjamin to use Yeast Wars as the basis for a threadbare, softcore bodice-ripper movie directed by her friend Lonnie, played by Hector Jimenez, whose mouth is a rictus of lust. Nutty and campy as all this is, there's a serious theme. Vastly disparate sexual issues are being worked out through these outlandish fantasies. Each vision is different, and in the end, Benjamin has to stand up like any artist and fight for his own vision. Some of Hesse's gross-out gags are heavy-handed. The grotesquerie is laid on too thick. His work is best when he doesn't force it, when he lets you observe, casually, his menagerie of weirdos. But Gentleman Broncos is a leap over his previous work. Now, Hess doesn't just gaze on paralyzed nerds from the outside. He takes you into their heads and gives form to their alienation from the physical world. Hess is a Mormon from a famously modest culture, yet he's clearly inspired by David Lynch. Even his flattest images teem with creepy undercurrents. I was always on the verge of either laughing or squirming, sometimes both at once. Let's call that verge Hess Country, where even your tackiest dreams can take flight.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
A white-haired man came by our studios the other day, sitting right in this room. He wore a dark suit, had a smile on his face. Wasn't much over 5 feet tall, though he is considered a giant in journalism. Harold Evans is 81. He's written a memoir of his life in British newspapers. As a teenager, he worked in a small city in England during World War II.
One of my first jobs was to knock on a door and get a photograph from the parents who'd lost their son in the fighting in World War II. And I'll never forget walking up and down the street. I did not want to knock on that door. I just simply didn't want to embarrass them, prey on their grief by saying, "Your son's been killed, give me a photograph." I finally had to sack myself, knowing that if I went back to the office I'd just started, I wouldn't be sacked. And I knocked on the door and they said, "Oh, come in, lad, have a cup of tea. Do you want the photograph of Steve?"
Harold Evans believes the family welcomed him because he came from the local paper. It was the kind of paper that made connections with the community. He thinks it's the kind of paper reporters could learn from today, whether they work for an old newspaper or a new website. Harold Evans went on to edit one of the leading papers in London, and he recalls that job in his book, My Paper Chase. What got you started when you were editor of the Sunday Times, pushing for stories about thalidomide, which many Americans will know or recall was a drug that was prescribed to pregnant women, which turned out to cause birth defects?
I looked at some photographs of a child without arms, no legs either, so I thought, well, how are they going to manage? So when I became editor of the Sunday Times, I thought, well, I must check how these children are doing. Well, I found that I wasn't allowed to check. Why? Because the Minister of Health had refused to have a public inquiry, the parents were forced to sue. And in English law, if you start a legal case, nobody is allowed to look into the facts, still less campaign about it.
You repeatedly published photos of children who had grown up or were growing up without arms, without legs, without both, and decided to publish even after your own lawyer, whom you write that you trust, said, "This is not wise. This will get you in trouble with the courts." How hard a decision was that?
It actually wasn't very difficult. Once I decided to do it, I thought, well, if the justice system will sanction this kind of treatment after 10 years, no compensation of any decent kind for these kids, if the courts will sanction that, well, there's something wrong enough, and if I go to prison because I'm challenging it, it will be such a manifest injustice, I'll live with it. I'd rather live with having tried to do something than having turned away because I was scared for my own carcass. So when I began the campaign, actually, of course, we got massive support from the readers, so I was merely, in a way, a vehicle for the popular will to express itself. But before the popular will could express itself, we had to do something which only a newspaper could do.
So what happened when you began publishing these stories in defiance of the law?
Well, the government jumped on me and took me to the High Court, where I lost. Then I went to the Appeal Court and I won. And then they took me to the House of Lords and we lost. And then I decided to challenge them under the European Convention of Human Rights. So I flew in bumpy aircraft to Strasbourg, where we presented our arguments. And I'll never forget going to the final verdict, and these judges came in their crimson robes, very, very dignified, and they went one by one. We find a breach of Article 12. We do not find a breach. We do find a breach. We don't find a breach. It was like this, like a game of ping pong.
So you're counting and as you're going along.
The counting went along, and we won 13-11, which meant that one vote either side had to be in a stalemate.
That's a pretty close football game.
Yeah, that 13-11, however, imposed a duty on the British government to reform the laws so that free speech was possible for cases of manifest injustice.
I'd like to ask what happened to the thalidomide victims, because we did have a situation where the distributor in Britain was offering them some money. You felt not nearly enough. Then they raised the offer as the case went on. What happened after that?
Well, we did in the end get what everybody recognized or thought at the time was adequate compensation, a trust of £20 million, the money to be administered according to the needs of the children as they were there. Now, when I went back to Britain for my paper chase publication in the United Kingdom, they turned up at the Cheltenham Literary Festival and in London, and they told a very sad story, which was the money had helped enormously. But they are now inhabit bodies that are 25 years older than their chronological age, so they're breaking down, basically. I met one woman, the money enables her to have a caregiver for 30 hours a week. For the rest of the hours in a week, without legs and without arms, she's living alone, trying to turn the light on, trying to cook. So it seems to me that the government, which prescribed this terrible drug, should accept the moral and legal responsibility of dealing with the consequences. So we still have to campaign to get the... I feel like saying, hello, haven't you heard this one before?
Too bad you're not still editing a newspaper, I suppose.
Well, some people are glad I'm not editing a newspaper anymore.
Well, you do write in this memoir, you give it the subtitle, My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times. What has vanished?
Oh, for the whole technology, for a start, for instance. I mean, when I was growing up, there were no telephones in our office, no telephones in most houses, for instance. I typed on an Underwood typewriter with four carbon copies. A young reporter today, or a writer today on it, they don't know they're born with the computer.
What has vanished editorially, if anything?
That's a more provocative question, because almost anything I say will sound like sour grapes. He would say that, wouldn't he, because he hasn't got a newspaper anymore, although I might get one day again. I think a certain commitment to the public good has vanished in the race for circulation. I think that is accentuated when you get newspapers taken over, as you have across America, by people who either borrow extensively by the paper or never had any interest in what real journalism is about in the first place. So the first thing they start doing is cutting editorial. So the kind of investigative journalism, which I think is the absolute essence, is in danger, and in fact in many places has vanished. We have to have this searchlight to know what the hell's going on. So when newspapers or TV neglect reporting, so you get chunks of opinion without any factual basis whatsoever, we're all going to suffer for it.
Harold Evans is the author of a memoir, My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt of that book at npr.org.
The New York Yankees are world champions again. They beat the Philadelphia Phillies 7-3 last night in the Bronx behind the pitching of Andy Pettitte and the hitting of Hideki Matsui, who knocked in 6 runs. At times, the Yankees were so good and their roster so loaded with talent that it's easy to regard their accomplishment as inevitable. But as NPR's Mike Pesca reports, they don't see it that way.
It might seem that all the Yankees have to do every year is not screw up. They always have the highest payroll, they often purchase the services of the year's best free agents, and they have as longtime employees a veritable Mount Rushmore of baseball winners, Jeter, Posada, Rivera, and Pettitte. But manager and former player Joe Girardi, who, like the names just mentioned, is beginning to fill his fingers up with championship rings, is here to tell you winning 103 games during the season and the requisite 11 in the postseason is hard work.
All I think about is all the people that it takes to do something like this and how difficult this really is. And man, I remember as a player, this is not an easy feat.
Over the last 2 seasons, it was hard to point to any major mistakes Girardi made, except for one. That he wasn't the last Yankee manager, Joe Torre. So this world championship buys him respect and perhaps even the love of Yankees fans. Another Yankee who needed a World Series win to prove something was Alex Rodriguez. A-Rod's boss, Hank Steinbrenner, said the most talented player in the game did just that.
He was amazing. Yeah, I mean, he proved himself in the clutch. Nobody can ever question him again, period.
Actually, exclamation mark. After 18 RBIs and huge hits this postseason, it can now never be said of Rodriguez. Sure, he's a good player, but he's never won at all. He just did, which, as Derek Jeter is here to remind us...
This is not easy. Let's just reiterate that once again. It's not easy to win a championship.
There are no other locker rooms in professional sports where after a championship, that reminder flows as freely as the champagne. The Yankees put more pressure on themselves than any other team, the kind of pressure that Hank Steinbrenner acknowledges, and let's face it, perpetuates.
Well, for the Yankees, 9-year drought's a long time. But for anybody else, it's nothing. But for us, it is a long time.
What other owner would just ignore the fact that the Yankees had the best record in baseball during that drought and won 2 American League pennants? Phillies manager Charlie Manuel took a forgiving tone with his team in defeat.
I love the way they played, and we definitely were fighters, and we never quit. I'm proud to be their manager, and I'm proud to have guys on our team with the makeup and the fight that they have, determination.
But no one was a more determined fighter than Andy Pettitte, whose solid pitching performance last night earned him a 5th ring. Pettitte knows what it means to be a Yankee.
It's an awful high standard to set. When you start a season, you say the season's going to be a failure if you don't win a championship. And that ain't good pressure to have. But these guys, we dealt with it, we embraced it, and we did it, man. And it makes it even a sweeter feeling.
It comes with the territory, comes with the pinstripes, that mandate to win. This year, the Yankees have done just that, satisfying themselves, delighting their fans, and helping the sport itself, which can draw motivation from the fact that the Yankees are once again the toughest out in baseball. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
On to another story now. Capitol Hill was abuzz with activity today in anticipation of a vote Saturday in the House on its huge health care overhaul bill. Today, the Democrats' bill got some key endorsements, one from the huge senior group, AARP, the other from the American Medical Association. And the bill's most important backer, President Obama, applauded those endorsements.
And I urge Congress to listen to AARP, listen to the AMA, and pass this reform for hundreds of millions of Americans who will benefit from it.
Meanwhile, a couple of thousand people rallied outside the Capitol with Republicans. They were protesting what they call a government takeover of health care.
With us to sort out the day's events and look ahead to the big vote is NPR's Julie Robner. Julie, let's talk about these endorsements first. Will the backing of the AARP and the American Medical Association have much of an impact?
Well, it could. There's a piece in this week's New England Journal of Medicine by two pollsters from Harvard who looked at 30 different national polls on health care. What they concluded is that these bills are so big and confusing, people will judge them by looking at how they will affect each person individually. And to do that, they're going to turn to groups that they trust. And in a poll done by NPR, the Kaiser Family Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health earlier this fall, the public put a lot of trust in groups like the AARP, the AMA, and the American Cancer Society, which also endorsed the Democrats' bill today.
Do the Democrats have the votes they need to pass a bill?
Actually, from everything I'm hearing, they don't, at least not yet. That's because of two issues that have been dividing them for months now, abortion and immigration. On immigration, there is no question that people here illegally should not be entitled to federal benefits, but there is a fight over whether they should be able to use their own money to buy into these new marketplaces called exchanges. On abortion, the fight's even more heated. Democrats are divided over how strictly to ban the use of public funds for abortion. There was quite the demonstration outside House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office this afternoon by anti-abortion protesters. About a dozen people were arrested.
Now, the Republicans plan to offer their own alternative bill. It's said to be a much slimmer volume. Is that likely to attract any wavering Democrats?
Well, probably not. The Congressional Budget Office last night issued its estimate of the Republican alternative. It includes a lot of familiar Republican proposals like capping damages and medical malpractice lawsuits, letting small businesses band together to sell insurance policies. But the CBO says the GOP alternative would cover only about 3 million currently uninsured people. And while it would reduce health insurance premiums on average, it would probably increase them for people who are less healthy and for people who live in some states compared to others. Even some Republicans say they're not all that happy with the Republican alternative. So right now it looks like it's the Democrats' bill or nothing, and we'll probably find out the answer to that question this weekend.
Thank you, Julie.
You're welcome.
That was NPR's Julie Robner.